thank you very much for those thoughtful comments from all of the panelists, and I'd like to open up the floor for discussion. And since we have no microphones, I'd ask that you please speak up. Also, identify yourself and the organization that you're with. Yes.
My name is from the University of Maryland. I have a quick question. What is Russia's policy for the arrival of the U.S. and for the four countries? Again, the question is, what is Russia's policy for the Pakistani Indian arrival?
That's a very, very broad question, but any of you would like to
let me just say quickly that I don't think that anybody here at the table is going to speak on behalf of the Russian government. But I can tell you that in the crises that have occurred over the last, since December last year, we've worked very closely with Russia, and Russia has played a role in helping to defuse the tensions.
One thought I would add, I think it's perhaps in this case,
let me see if I can take it down.
Betty, can we pass the microphone back and forth?
How do you take this thing out? Technologically. Okay, great. Okay, sorry about this.
One of two things is going to happen. Either I'm going to have had more time to think about what I was going to say, and it's going to be particularly brilliant, or I'm going to have forgotten what I was going to say. What I was going to say is I think it's pertinent to recall or to stress what Russian policy is not with regard to South Asia. There was a fairly sustained period in the late Yeltsin period when some forces in Russia, particularly those associated with former foreign minister and prime minister Yevgeny Primakov, were tempted by the idea of a strategic cooperative triangle bringing together Russia, India, and China as a kind of offset to the great hegemon of the United States. That had already receded, I think, by September 11th for lots of reasons having to do with changes in the Russian leadership, but it is certainly dead and buried now. Nonetheless, Russia's relations with India for historical as well as geopolitical reasons remain pretty strong, much better than their relations with Pakistan. Dear.
Thank you. Bottom line is, we believe that Pakistan is a stable nation, but that there are very strong elements of extremism present there is not a surprise to anybody. And as I mentioned in my speech, this is a major challenge that faces General Musharraf and any other government that comes in, or any other secular government that comes in, because there are very strong extremist forces, which not all of which come from Afghanistan, some that are indigenous within Pakistan. And I'll leave it at that.
Yes, in the very back.
Harry Thomas from the Voice of America. I was wondering, with the election coming up in Pakistan, whether how federal, how things there is being viewed, given that two of the major players would be considered major players, Lula and Sharif, and the sideline constitutional changes that Musharraf has put through. Are these elections going to be this year?
Could you direct your question at an individual?
I think, first of all, we're not going to prejudge these elections. There's a lot of pre-election things going on. We are not going to be in a position to prejudge them until they occur. But we have stated since the beginning, in fact, since October 1999, that a return to democracy is a priority for the United States, and it's something which we still maintain today.
Okay. Yes, in the back there on the right hand here.
First of all, I don't believe that we've ever described the issue in quite the way you've described it, so I just want to make clear that's your description. Our position on this is clear. Obviously, we care a lot about the Kashmiri people who have valid grievances, and we have, through the years, I believe, it's always been a part of our parlance on the issue of Kashmir. It still is. But we also, the bottom line is that we think that the issue needs to be resolved between India and Pakistan. And so that is one of the reasons why we're pushing them towards dialogue in the way that we've been doing.
Naeem, did you want anybody?
Yeah, I think Harb has made a very valid point that in this discussion on Kashmir, Kashmiris have been very often left out, and the Kashmiri groups, the separatist groups in Kashmir have received support from Pakistan, and those who received support, they often tended to follow Pakistani directives, and those who haven't are being kind of cut off. And now there is this concern that a deal between India and Pakistan might leave Kashmiri government in the hand of people chosen by Delhi rather than people chosen by people of Kashmir. And the Kashmiri militant groups speaking privately express great frustration that they are being left out of the equation. And the fact that this leader visited Delhi last week saw many politicians, but government certainly not Vajpayee or Deputy Prime Minister who received them, was very discouraging to this group. And the question really is whether the government would wait for a situation where they can do a deal with Pakistan or accept the Kashmiri groups, Kashmiri people's representatives as their real partner, is going to be an issue of long-term stability, because one cannot have a solution without addressing the grievances of the population of Kashmir.
There was a gentleman very back, just had a stand up for one. Yes, you.
Moving arms control in the past, but he's been involved in informal talks among scientists, strategists, were extremely important in the U.S.-Soviet . What kind of infrastructure of informal dialogue exists on nuclear issues?
Dan, I'm used to this with you. Those are terrific questions. On the first point, I think there's no question that what you call the broader architecture is the one that's required. There is, of course, the danger of a vicious cycle in the continuing development and deployment of nuclear weaponry on either side of the India-Pakistan hyphen. But as the Indians repeatedly and quite properly tell us, they are more than a regional power, more than a South Asian power. They're indeed a power with global aspirations and interests, and that includes their relationship, which has been problematic, with the People's Republic of China. And they often cite the concerns that they have about deterring China in explaining to us the rationale for their weapons programs. It therefore ought to follow logically from that that they should be very careful about what would be the consequences of a vicious cycle developing in the Indo-China relationship, that is the nuclear strategic relationship. Not only, if not handled correctly, could it exacerbate the buildup and the political underlying factors of that relationship, that is the one between India and China, it could also have consequences that reach beyond China itself. As China builds up in response, among other things, to Indian programs, that could have an influence in the long term over Russian programs. Events in the Korean Peninsula are highly unpredictable and still very, very risky. It's well beyond the scope, not to mention the time frame of this panel discussion this afternoon, but it's not unimaginable that we could end up in a world with two nuclear-armed Koreas, which would perhaps have some tie-in to what happens in South Asia. And then, of course, there are the implications for Japan and Japan, the danger or the possibility that Japan will revisit its own nuclear options over the long run. India is now playing in that game. And I think in our conversations with them, whether they're official or unofficial, we need to use the better relationship that now exists to try to help them think that through. And that goes to your second point. I have felt all along, even back before May 98, that there was an important role for the NGO think tank community, indeed institutions like the U.S. Institute for Peace, the Arms Control Association, and other bodies of that kind, to carry out what might be called Track 2 or Track 3 discussions with both the Indians and the Pakistanis. We in the U.S. government, and I think the Bush administration is in a somewhat similar position, had to be careful since India and Pakistan had put themselves outside the bounds of the NPT, not to be in the position of giving them a user's manual on how to be a nuclear weapon state. That was a constraint on our ability to work with them as candidly and imaginatively as some would have liked on these issues. But the NGO world, the Track 2 world, is not constrained in that fashion and I think can be very helpful to them.
Ms. Rocca will have to leave in about 5 minutes, so what I'm going to do is we can be here for another 7 or 8, I suppose, but if there are questions that are for Secretary Rocca.
But feel free to share.
She's done her share, I guess. Yes, you can wait.
J.J. Martin from Asia Pacific Strategy. Just had a question really for Nayan and for Ms. Rocca, going back to the entire enmity and domestic policy. What does the rise
in international affairs affect both Pakistan and India relationship as well as the nation? It certainly does very much, because after all, you have to remember that the nuclear test was conducted by this Hindu nationalist government, and they have had always a very strong rhetoric about Kashmir, and they have been very adamant that they didn't want to give up the claim on the Pakistani-occupied Kashmir. So if the current BJP government, given its strong Hindu credentials, accepts the idea of a line of control as a permanent border, that would be much easier to sell in India. After all, you have to remember that under the Indian constitution, the whole of Kashmir belongs to India. So there is need to be modifying the constitution to make only the Jammu Kashmir and Ladakh part of Kashmir and giving up the western part of Kashmir. So in some ways, like Nixon going to China, this Hindu nationalist government actually is in a better position to achieve a settlement on Kashmir.
We have time for about two more questions, I'm afraid. You have been waiting for some time, yes.
I want to ask the panel, how critical is it to bring in Al-Qaeda or other Arab-based terrorist groups? And could those groups literally blame the situation between Pakistan and India? In other words, they do it deliberately, almost like a king of dynamite, and throwing a match into it just to spark a war and create more havoc.
I'll touch on it briefly and then I'll let others comment as well. I mean, I think this is something I touched upon in my remarks, not referring specifically to Al-Qaeda. Obviously, going after Al-Qaeda is priority one for this administration, so that is a given. And certainly, preventing Al-Qaeda from achieving any such objectives from within Pakistan or anywhere else is of extreme importance to us. But it isn't just Al-Qaeda. There are other extremist groups that would like to achieve the same objectives. And this is why one of the reasons that I cited for our concern about the continued mobilization between of these two armies, where they're eyeball to eyeball, it would take a major terrorist attack could inflame the situation. And there are terrorist groups out there who would like to provoke exactly that.
Okay, yes. I'm sorry.
Yes.
And then you can have the last one. Go ahead.
Wayne Merrick, Peacekeeping Center. Daniel preempted about half of my question about the role of China. Preemption seems to be very much fashionable in Washington these days. And Secretary Talbot addressed the India factor, but perhaps Secretary Rocha could tell us a bit more about the China-Pakistan factor. I mean, many people in the Pakistani army tend to see China as a permanent ally, whereas the Americans are sort of unreliable to come and go. China obviously has a very long-standing interest in the region. Now gets 30% of its oil imports by sea to the Middle East. It's very active engaging in Burma and Central Asia. In this last year, where China's participation in the Pakistani nuclear program has brought South Asia very close to a very dangerous brink, how have the Chinese participated? The Russians, I know, have tried to be helpful within the limitations of their relationships, which are mostly in India. But have the Chinese been, in parallel, helpful in their relationships, which are much more positive, if they wish to exercise them?
The Chinese viewed the threat of war between India and Pakistan with as much concern as we did. And they played a very helpful role during this crisis. We were in very close contact. The Secretary was in close contact with all the foreign ministers constantly. I was meeting with my Chinese counterpart when they come here. We've had dialogues with them on this, and they were very helpful in helping to defuse the tensions, I would say, throughout the entire year. They've got as much interest in preventing nuclear war in the region as we do.
Okay, one last question, gentlemen in the back.
I'm Amit Patel from the Open Society Institute. I think that if we really want to understand the prospects of peace in South Asia, we really do have to step back a little bit from the immediate issues of statecraft that the panel has, I think, sort of very elegantly and precisely addressed. But India and Pakistan and their neighbors are in a downward spiral, political instability, misgovernment, weak party politics, impoverishment, economic disgovernment, etc., environmental degradation, physical conflict over natural resources, etc., etc. Now that's the larger context. Even if we had the optimal solution to each of the issues that all the panelists have addressed, you would still have that very volatile ground on which international conflict would break out inevitably. You would have appeals to sexual identity, you would have appeals to religious identity.
Sorry, could you, the question, please?
Yeah.
We're running out of time, so.
Well, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, the question would be, how can we conceivably restrict ourselves to thinking about these narrow and immediate issues of statecraft, when in fact the implications of that are that we ally ourselves with local elites, military elites, and economic elites at the cost of real change in the region that could lead to real reduction in defense.
This is a small question, right? It's a very small question. This is a very good question, and actually you're bringing to light something which we've been talking about a lot recently, which is the fact that what is seen by the world is our focus on these crises. The work on all the issues that you talked about continues apace. We are working very hard to address the root causes of the crisis in all the countries in the region, every single one of them. And so what you're seeing on a day-to-day basis is dealing with the crisis, but our work has gone on steadily and apace, and it is a top priority for us.
Christine, if you have to leave, I won't take it as a walkout and protest against my adding to your answer here. I think the question underscores, perhaps in a way it doesn't entirely intend to, a real paradox that all of us have to grapple with, and that is the limits and ambiguities of democratization. Like Christina, I worked for an administration that was very much committed to the promotion of democracy, to the defense of democracy, and to the criticism of regimes that came to power by undemocratic means, such as the Musharraf regime or government in Pakistan. That said, from my vantage point outside of government, and therefore without a lot of the constraints that Christine is operating under today, I couldn't help thinking in the immediate wake of September 11th how different things might have been, how much harder Colin Powell's work would have been in Islamabad if he had been dealing with a democratically elected government there. Now, there's no way to make this point without, A, getting in trouble with a lot of friends, and, B, being a bit personal. But those of us who worked with Nawaz Sharif in the wake of the Indian nuclear test in May 98 were not inspired by his ability to deal with various forces operating in Pakistan, notably including radical and extremist Islamic groups. And when our country was dealing with the immediate aftermath of 9/11, which crucially involved getting the Pakistanis to make a 180-degree turn with regard to their longstanding support of the Taliban and associated groups, I couldn't help thinking, sadly, with a high degree of philosophical ambivalence, just as glad it's President, i.e. General, Musharraf on the other end of those discussions and not the guy that some of us were dealing with. And I just leave that kind of as a counterpoint to the very good and certainly totally philosophically correct points that you make, and it goes to one of the dilemmas of what you call statecraft.
Thank you so much. I want to thank the panelists for an extremely